Hi, everyone, and welcome to the House of Pod. I'm Kaveh.
And I'm Lizzie.
And if this is your first time listening, we're a medical
sort of
podcast where we try to discuss medicine and health in a relatable way.
And we'll answer questions you may not feel comfortable asking your doctor and definitely won't bring up to your friends. On this episode, we're going to talk about whether or not it's important to be medically accurate in film and TV. And we interview Sharky Laguana, the founding member of the band Creeper Lagoon, about life on the road while touring, sleep hygiene, and addiction. Stay tuned.
The opinions expressed on this podcast are broadcasted for educational and informational purposes only and do not represent the opinions of our employers. These opinions are not intended as a diagnosis, treatment, or as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a local physician or other healthcare professional for your specific healthcare and/or medical needs or concerns.
Welcome back to the House of Pod. I'm Kaveh.
I'm Lizzie.
And I'm Joe.
Guys, I'm going to skip the part where I ask how we're doing.
Wait.
I'm going to tell you how I'm doing. I'm stoked. I'm excited. We have a guest coming on, and I'm really excited about this particular guest, Sharky.
I couldn't be more excited, honestly. He's from this band, Creeper Lagoon, and one of my all-time favorites. So
same.
It's just an absolute, what's the word?
Pleasure. Joy, honor,
joy,
privilege.
All of them that we're going to be able to meet him.
I hope he's not a jerk.
Well, I'm excited today, but I'm going to go back. My week wasn't great because
how was your week? I'm sorry.
No, what? Thanks for asking.
Yeah.
It wasn't great because I found out through Facebook that Nadeem Abu Baker, our behind-the-scenes producer.
Executive producer.
Had surgery, needs surgery. He tore his meniscus or something playing basketball because apparently he's the athlete in the family. And I found this out through Facebook. Yeah. And it hurt my feelings and my heart.
Yeah. Okay, he didn't tell you, call you directly?
He normally calls me to tell me these things.
Really?
Just for the listeners out there, Nadeem and I have never spoken on the phone and we've met like three times. So I'm a big fan of his.
Poor guy. This is his third
time. All basketball related.
He is wonderful. I love his insights on the show. And one thing he wrote when he was listening to the most recent episode was, "The House of Pod. You don't even need Percocet to make it through an episode."
Hey, that's high praise from Nadeem.
I was saying that.
Yeah, a drug reference from Nadeem.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm sure he's
that's
right.
Crazy.
He must be pretty narked up. I'm sure the new
he must be on a Percocet.
If he was funny, he must
right.
be high.
Right. No. I don't think he would know the word Percocet unless he was actually having to take one.
Like, yeah.
It's like someone forced him to take one.
I didn't know he's so square. That's cute.
Oh, yeah, I don't know if he's square, but.
Well, one thing also I did over the weekend was, is Nadeem, he's Pakistani, right?
Yeah.
So I thought a lot about him. I watched this movie, The Big Sick, which was written by this Pakistani comedian. Kamel.
Nanjiani, I think.
Nanjiani, yes. I think that's how you say it. I'm not 100% sure. And a lot of it was all based on this girl he was dating who was got really sick.
Yeah, Emily Gordon, I think, right?
Her name is Emily in the movie.
Okay.
Became her wife. His wife, sorry. And so much of it was like medically incorrect. And I really wanted to sort of talk about it on the show. And I think we'll get a movie person maybe who writes.
That's smart.
Like screenplays and stuff to tell
talk
us
about
how,
why Hollywood comes up with these things.
Yeah. Like how do you figure this out? How do you do this research? Because they said things like the first thing, as soon as she got sick, we're going to put her in a medically induced coma. And I've asked my ICU critical care friends, one of my good friends, Allison, you know, does this every day. And I asked her the other day, am I out of touch? Because I haven't worked in an ICU in 7 or 8 years. Mm-hmm. Do people use the term medically induced coma? And, you know, she was like, no, when someone's really sick and your lungs are really not functioning well, you put them on a breathing machine and you tell people that you're making them sleepy with medication to help them be comfortable. You don't use a term. Like, why would you ever use the word coma to set off alarms?
I've heard that term a lot, though.
But let me ask you this, though. Do you think it's inaccurate?
It's not inaccurate. And if
it's
patient,
just offensive
insensitive?
Not offensive. Insensitive, maybe?
It's just...
Maybe alarming is what you're saying.
Right.
Overly alarming.
It's alarming. The word coma is scary, right? And she said, if a patient asks, a patient family member says, are they in a coma? You know, she would respond, yes, it's like a coma, but, you know, and we are doing it. It is a medically induced coma, but you wouldn't start the conversation with, we're putting her in a medically induced coma. You know, you would say, We're helping her breathe on a machine to make the patient more comfortable until we can treat the infection.
It's not the language an actual doctor would use.
Yeah, that's it. I was just wondering about the common parlance. That, like, is this medical jargon? You know, well, and it is, but we don't use it.
It would be nice, and I have an idea about who we can get. But it would be nice to talk to someone who does screenwriting, because I'm sure what they have to do is they probably know. They probably do the research and they probably talk to a doctor, and the doctor's like, well, this is what we'd say. But they try to write it out in script and they're like, it doesn't flow. It doesn't. People aren't going to like to hear that. Like, do you really want to, like, your shows to, like, have real, if you're like the common listener, to have the real parlance of medicine? It might be boring.
Maybe it would, but, and maybe when he brings it back to his friends and his family and he talks about it, maybe he says medically induced coma, but they had a lot of physicians talking to the patients, and it just, and then there was another thing. They were like, we're going to take her in for surgery and remove the infection from her lung with a procedure called a thoracentesis. And all of this was so wrong. Ooh. And it just, and I honestly, I really like the movie. I don't want to trash a movie because I recommend it.
And
I
think we would
it
was, love to have one of those two people on as a guest. Don't mess that up.
No, I totally recommend it. And I was really excited to see it, and it didn't disappoint me, but there were things that just, you know, when an acting is bad or an accent is bad, it just takes you out of the movie.
Right,
and this
right.
is how I felt.
Explain what thoracentesis actually is.
So thoracentesis is, you know, you take fluid from around the lungs. So it's a needle procedure. The patient can be wide awake. You know, most of the ones that I was involved with when I was training, the patient was wide awake.
You don't consider it a surgery. It's not considered
it's
a surgery.
Totally, it's like a procedure. Very minimally invasive procedure. It's probably safer or similar to a colonoscopy, you know, and there's no sedation. You just numb up the area on the skin near the ribs and you put a needle in and you remove fluid. And sometimes it's more involved, but it's certainly not surgery.
It sounds like what they meant to say was thoracotomy or something like that, where they actually make an incision and then go in.
100%. There's something that was wrong. Yeah. A procedure called a thoracentesis, a surgery called a thoracentesis are incongruent. And it just is frustrating.
I remember we spoke earlier on in one of the earliest episodes about which show we thought was most medically accurate. Mm-hmm. And I said,
which TV
show? I think.
I thought you were referencing House of Pod.
Same with me.
I'm like, we're always accurate.
Damn straight. But the one show that I changed my mind. I said Scrubs, and Scrubs is fun. Cause Scrubs captures the pathos, as Raja Jagadeesan, one of our earlier guests, mentioned. But there is a show that actually is underrated in terms of its medical knowledge, and that's Lost. Now, I know it sounds funny, but one of the main characters on Lost is a surgeon, and there's a lot of these acute sort of instances that come up during the show that he has to address, and they cover it pretty well. Like, there's a guy who gets crushed by a plane and he's trying to work out the problem. But since he didn't know it was a crush injury, he didn't treat the patient the right way. Oh. And it's like, really, I mean, he even brings it up. He's like, why didn't you tell me what happened? It would have changed the way I addressed this. And he was totally right.
So their medical consultant was good. We should get that guy on the show.
For real. And I'll tell you this. There's a scene in one of the guys, like one of the others in their house, and you see in the background, there's the ICU book. It was like the Bible that I read. I don't know if you had the same one. Yeah. Like the blue one, right? Like the light blue one.
Yeah, it was Marino. I think I have it.
Oh, it's like one of the coolest books ever. It deals with all these crazy ICU topics in a very accessible way for doctors. Anyways, they had that in the background. I'm like, boom, someone knows what they're doing in this show.
Yeah, exactly. That's true. Anyway, I thought the movie was great, but these inaccuracies just sort of took me out of it a little bit. And I was just thinking we should talk to somebody about how you can write it in TV and movies to be accurate, but also dramatic. You know, you don't want to remove it. I understand the jargon is really, you know, boring, you know, sometimes.
Yeah. It's got to be accurate, though, or at least not have a trend of mistakes like that.
I mean, we're not the target audience for that. People don't care what we think. We're such a small doctors are such a small population of the movie going people. I don't think they care.
Yeah.
But yeah, we'll talk about that someone. Let's get someone.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Good movie though, The Big Sick. I enjoyed it. When we come back, we're gonna talk with Sharky LaGuana. Stay tuned.
Sharky LaGuana,
yes,
musician
from
one of the greatest bands to ever come out of San Francisco.
Not true.
In my humble opinion,
okay,
which is usually correct. He's from the band Creeper Lagoon. I'm going to give people a little bit of background about this. In 1998, they were Spin's Best New Artist. They came out with this album, I Become Small and Go, which was awesome. and I thought pretty groundbreaking. 2001, Take Back the Universe and Give Me Yesterday, also a fantastic album. It was featured, a couple songs were featured on Vanilla Sky in Orange County, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the band broke up around 2001.
Yeah.
And you went on with a new lineup and released Remember the Future, which was also awesome. Mm. And now you're doing something called Bandigo. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Am I saying that correctly? It's Bandigo.
Yep, perfect.
Fantastic. What is it?
It is a van rental company that originally started to cater to musicians, hence the name Bandigo. Mm-hmm. I know it sounds like Vandigo, but it's B as in boy, Bandigo. Mm-hmm. And... basically it just came from my own experiences touring, which was you're trapped in a van for 10 to 12 hours a day. There's nothing to do. So right off the bat, we started off with this idea that was basically Virgin America before Virgin America was Virgin America. So we put in video screens and game systems and lighting systems and, comfortable seating. And we just made it like a more comfortable place to hang out for weeks on end, which is what most musicians wind up doing. And as time went by, it wasn't ever sort of explosive growth until perhaps recently. But
when did you start it?
2003.
Okay.
So it was just a van parked in front of my apartment on Hampshire Street.
That sounds a tiny bit creepy, but I like it. It's like I live in a van down by the river,
Yeah, right. Yeah. So the big exciting thing for us right now is this spring we're going to try and launch a new line if we can get the prototypes built. We're going to do a new line and a new brand, same location, same company, but just a sort of like a separate division called Campigo.
Oh, cool.
Wow.
Oh my God. It's like my Vanagon. I had a whole Vanagon story. It was an awesome and unique, strange experience.
This all sort of relates to what we wanted to talk to you about, which is that physical toll that you must face when you're on the road and you're touring. Because you are stuck in the small, cramped little space. You're going from town to town. There's lack of sleep. There's problems, I'm sure, keeping your regular routines, eating well, avoiding drinking, that sort of thing. We see all these people sort of become these sort of rock and roll casualties and like rock and roll cliches. You seem to have avoided that. How did you do that?
So for whatever reason, I don't have that gene that
the adrenaline junkie gene.
No. The addictive gene. Mm-hmm. So I definitely had a pretty severe sort of self-medicating marijuana habit, back during that time, which was, in hindsight, clearly just a way to sort of manage the various stresses that we were under and whatever childhood traumas, yada yada.
Yeah.
And certainly as a musician, you're inevitably exposed to and for a variety of different reasons wind up participating in a large array of stuff.
Yeah.
And I never nothing ever connected with me on that level where I felt like I got to do this again. I got to, and often, my experiences were mainly about trying to prevent my bandmate who was severely addictive and just trying to be there with him.
Right.
And it was sort of like this weird, okay, if I'm doing it with him, I can keep him safe and kind of be somebody that's on his side instead of be this, sort of outside force.
Yeah, like a brotherly role as opposed to judging or isolation.
It was a theory that didn't really pan out. So this idea that you're going to coax somebody through rehab by joining them and, at least partially in their sort of abuse habits.
It's probably a common misconception that you think that you can help someone by, like, I bet you that's how a lot of very young, naive people start. Like, oh, if you're doing it, it's okay, and I can watch you. It's
a codependency. There's an enabling here. It's hard to avoid if you're trying to help your friend sometimes.
A band is inherently and implicitly codependent. It's like being a small squad in a war or, you know, something like that, because there's just incredible outside pressure. There's no escape from each other.
Right.
And you're in tall, you know, sort of small confined spaces.
Right. Nobody else has, I think of sometimes med school and residency.
Yeah.
Like I say, some of these people, it's like you've gone to war with them because nobody else has that same schedule. Nobody is up 27 hours except you and that other person. Nobody else has that test on Monday so that you're partying Monday night. Like nobody else has the same routine as you except for these people that you're obviously just in a very close confinement with.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, there's a couple parallels like that in life, but it's actually fairly rare for human beings to be sort of trapped together so closely and so intimately. I've certainly have spent more continuous hours with my bandmates than I have with my wife or my kids or my friends. It's not natural to spend that much time that closely with the same people. So it was interesting, you know, we took a 18, 17 year hiatus. And then we came back and we did some shows and it was incredibly emotionally powerful to all be in the same room and just immediately realize that, wow, we really know each other and we're still fundamentally the same people.
It's totally like family, like, you know, after that time.
But a lot has changed since then and we've all progressed and we've actually become
closer because of it now.
Closer and better versions of ourselves back then. I mean, you know, I mentioned a bandmate had a lot of issues. He was able to, it was a remarkable story. He was able to work himself out of those issues without ever getting into any kind of program or rehab or
trouble.
He got into a lot of trouble, a couple car accidents and, you know, some other disasters, but, he survived all of them. And now he he came out and he's in this like incredibly healthy place where he can have a beer or two at dinner or a glass of wine.
That's pretty rare.
Never heard of it. I've never seen it. Yeah. And I wouldn't have believed it if I hadn't seen it with my own eyes.
Because usually having zero beers, if you're an alcoholic or having addiction issues, is much easier than having one beer. So that really is incredible.
Yeah.
So I have a question. So you talked about addiction and on the road. And, you know, we were talking earlier about when I travel, I get totally out of my routine. Like it's harder to figure out time and space to exercise, again, to not overeat or overdrink or whatever when I'm out. What advice do you have if you didn't do it well in your 20s, let's say? What advice would you have for people on the road now, whether it's a musician or
A
traveling salesman or a physician?
Do they exist? I don't know if they exist, but if they did.
Yeah.
Right. Or any profession where you're totally don't have a routine. I know friends who are device reps who just are constantly traveling, you know?
Right.
So how do you do that? How do you maintain? What advice would you have to maintain some sort of healthy lifestyle, you know?
Well, I think there's a lot of science that suggests it's very important to have habits and patterns, that it's a way of kind of luring your body into sort of sleep state, right? So I think when we were touring, you know, the internet wasn't really here to tell us everything that we needed to know about sleep habits. There was no internet, pretty much.
God, your sleep hygiene must have been awful.
Oh, you get to bed at 3 o'clock in the morning, you have to get up at 8 or sometimes at 5 to go to some stupid radio show and you're supposed to be charming and witty and then you got to drive for 8 hours and you're just in.
You're like, I hate everyone.
So, you know, of course this is a huge concern for me because now I run a transportation company and these folks are driving their vans. And over many, many years, we have had some really horrible accidents.
You think related to sleep?
Oh, every single one was absolute. Every single accident we've ever had that was serious.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had fatalities. We've had, life-changing injuries. And every single time it was, we had one not long ago where the guys didn't want to pay for a hotel room. So they drove all night. Mm-hmm. And then they stop at a pancake house, Waffle House, one of those things.
Let's plug IHOP. It's delicious.
Yeah. And they totally carb up.
Mm.
on no sleep. And so what happens predictably half an hour later, like they go into, you know,
sleep coma kind of thing.
Yeah. Pancake coma.
Classic.
And the result was, quite a few people perished in that accident. So I'm always, you know, having been through that and having experienced that as, you know, sort of firsthand, and I know what it's like, especially kind of, there's this sort of vortex of hell that's in between, nobody knows who you are and household name.
Right.
And that vortex of hell is you don't have the money to pay for like things to be comfortable. You're not checking into the Four Seasons and, you know, getting amazing bedding. You're still in like some shitty hotel somewhere. That's like a 1 or 2 star. And, the bedding's wrong and you can hear your neighbors next door doing drugs and there's a party beneath you and like, you know, kids running around above you. And, you know, having been through that, I know what it's like to live in a state of perpetual exhaustion. And there's so many different things that sort of intercede to exacerbate that and, and make it worse. So, you know, we're really, you know, very aggressive about encouraging bands to, you know, whoa, your tour is looking kind of crazy. You're going to wind up paying more money because we charge per mile after 250 miles. There's a business case to be made that we should switch to unlimited miles and just charge a little more and then nobody has to worry about miles.
Right.
But I keep it in there because I think there's a human case to be made that if you drive more than X number of miles per day consistently, you're putting yourself at risk. You're putting the company at risk. You're putting your bandmates at risk. I think you should pay more for that risk and everybody else shouldn't have to pay more so that you can be a dum-dum. So we've kind of stuck to that and we talk about it on the website too. Like, you know, it's, you don't have to look at America as this place where you have to go from, you know, one city to the next and every trip, you know, every travel between every city needs to be 6 to 8 hours. You could do Oakland and then San Francisco and then San Jose, and then you're sleeping in the same hotel 3 nights, you know.
Yeah.
This is a hard thing to talk to about, like, young kids who are in a band and they have this very Spartan work ethic and they all want to be like the Minutemen and like get into a van and travel like 1,000 miles to like the next gig.
Well, the Minutemen's a classic example of how that can go wrong.
What happened? I don't know.
D. Boone died in a van accident. He was sleeping in the back and somebody was driving and I think it was his girlfriend and forgive me if I get the story wrong, but basically it was similar situation.
Yeah.
Not enough sleep.
Yeah.
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 I mean, how do you convince or do you even try? I mean, how much can you do? If you were sitting with a young musician and having this discussion, what would you tell them?
Because the ideal version, the sexy lifestyle of being in a band is like, let's go for a tour, you know, and it's like it is pursuing that like all-nighter kind of thing. So I feel like part of the dream is maybe trying to, you know, recreate some of these moments.
Yeah, I think a lot of the biggest danger moments are when you try and recreate fantasies that never really existed in the first place. You know, there's a lot of bands out there that, you know, we'll see old documentaries on Led Zeppelin or whoever smashing up hotel rooms and they're like, wow, that sounds cool. And I want to do that, you know? And, thing is, well, they were getting paid $800,000 for that show. So like, it didn't really matter if they caused $20,000 of damage to, you know, the hotel room and they were, you know, they had a plane with their own beds on it and, you know,
nice.
That's
your next, business adventure. Yeah. It's plane to go.
Right. Plane to go. Yeah. I'll, register the domain as soon as the podcast is over
right away.
If somebody hasn't beaten me to it. But, you know, there's a lot of danger in the fantasies that are out there. And I think people would be shocked at how disciplined often the people that actually do succeed, especially now when competition, I think, is tougher than ever. I think people would be shocked at how disciplined these artists are and how attentive they are to...
their health,
kind of everything about their health. I mean, the most astounding example I can think of is, I mean, someday just take 5 seconds out of your life and pull up footage of the Rolling Stones performing. Mick Jagger is, what, 72, 73?
70s, yeah, for
running
sure.
around.
Yeah. I can't do what he's doing. And he does it for 2.5 hours. Yeah. And if you think it's just like some crazy fluke,
right. There's
footage, you know, of him doing his yoga and his stretches. And,
oh my God, yeah. And Bruce plays for like 3 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny because everyone, when they start playing music, I think they... there's a part of the drinking and there's part of the drugs just to help them do it, perform, to help them perform live, to get over that stage fright, to do it. But it's really hard to maintain any sort of healthy lifestyle while touring and drinking constantly. But that gets ingrained to musicians so early. Like, you don't do a show unless you're a little bit messed up. Because you do them in bars. You start off in dive bars. You're playing. You're drinking before your show.
People are buying you drinks.
People
you
are guys, buying you drinks a ton.
These even, guys that performed, I definitely bought you guys drinks. Sorry.
Even
art. Sorry.
Yeah, contributing to our delinquency.
Sorry,
thank you.
It's my fault.
So it's really hard to break that cycle early on.
Well, you know, there's sort of another, I think, for musicians in particular, another competing factor here, which is the kinds of people that... fall in love with music to the point that they want to pursue this as a career. They're that passionate about it, and they're willing to kind of put themselves through all this stress and effort to kind of get there. Psychologically, it's my experience. Certainly, it was true for me. It was true, I think, for all my bandmates. It's true for 99% of the musicians I've met in my life. There's some fundamental trauma or you know, issue, mental health issue.
Lizzie's pointing
both
to Joe and
guys.
I right now as he says that.
I know what you mean, though. There's a certain creativity that comes from having pain, right?
I you know, one of the things I think about it, I think I read this somewhere, is music is an attempt to make order out of chaos. And it's you know, taking something that's sort of like fundamentally crazy and trying to channel it into something that feels like it makes sense and is taking you someplace. And the other thing that I think about, this is just sort of my own internal theory, which is music, when it's at its best, is really just reporting. But instead of reporting the facts, you know, it's raining today in San Jose and it's 78 degrees, right? Like, that's a kind of reporting. Mm-hmm. This is a different kind of reporting. This is how I feel right now, being me in this particular place and in this particular time. And when I examine my emotions, this is what comes out, and this is what it's like to be me and feel like I do. And I think that is when people really tap into that on a you know, real honest, essential level. That's when other people go, holy shit, I'm getting the truth now. I'm getting something real. And this is what creates authenticity. This is why a reggae band in Seattle is not as compelling as a reggae band in Jamaica. And this is why a, you know, grunge band in Jamaica is not as compelling as a grunge band in Seattle, because it's about reporting, you know, who they are and how they really feel and what's going on, without like sort of trying to, you know, ride somebody else's experience.
It sounds like a great form of therapy. You know, you're talking about sort of channeling it, and it's just, if people could do that in a meaningful way and not necessarily do it for the wrong reasons, like fame and audience and accolades, you know, if you're doing it for your own reasoning, that sounds like a great like benefit.
You know, though, what's interesting is I can see how it is in some forms of therapy, but if you're really being authentic to the song, I heard Bono say something once where he was like, I can't sing the notes right unless I'm emotionally where I was when I wrote that song. Like, do you think there's sort of a risk to your mental health to always have to put yourself in some sort of, if you're really being authentic, to putting yourself in that weird mental space again and again and again every night?
Yeah, how do you keep it fresh and real and authentic?
That's without losing your mind and being clinically depressed.
Well, you know, I feel sort of very fortunate and blessed that the music that we made is, I feel, at its core, optimistic and hopeful and warm and loving. And so to come back into, you know, just, this isn't every musician's experience by far. Like, I'm, you know, who is it? Chester,
Bennington.
Yes.
The guy from Linkin Park.
Yeah. And Linkin Park is essentially, you know, all of their music is about being alienated and depressed. Yeah. And
He committed suicide. He committed suicide 4 or 5 months ago, I think.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Whereas, you know, our music definitely has sad elements and things that are sort of examining pain. But they do it through our writing. You know, when I look back on it, it tends to do it through this almost sort of hopeful lens and or bittersweet lens. And so to come back into that and I had a couple thoughts. One is, holy shit, we were a lot more timeless than I realized. Like,
I was just saying to these guys before you came in, and I'm going to try not to be too effusive here, but I was listening again to I Become Small and Go. It holds up.
Yeah.
I mean, it holds up completely now. And that doesn't go for every late 90s act or 2001 act, you know. It really holds up still. And I think not just the sound, not just the vocals, not just the recording, but at what you said, at the heart of it, there's always this optimism. To me, great music has to run the gambit of emotions. You have to have a little bit of humor, some sadness and happiness and all that stuff. And you have all that stuff, but at the core of it, there is this sort of underlying optimism and hope in the music. I think that's a big part of why it holds up still.
Right.
That's what people do when they meditate. It is. It's like reinforcing positivity, you know, whether or not that's how you feel, you're trying to convince yourself. So if you can take yourself to that time, again, it sounds like a great way to do it. Just as a side note, Mick Jagger is 74, close to 75.
It's pretty impressive.
Just want you guys to know.
And I just saw footage of him from like 2 weeks ago, and I can't do what he's doing now.
Right.
Like, I'm not even close.
And just for our listeners, he's nowhere near 60. Far younger than 60.
Sharky,
yes. Sorry.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, people don't necessarily, they can Google you.
Yeah. But, right.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, sort of wrap up that last bit. When we reformed and I first started rehearsing the music, it was, it was kind of like a constant, I was just rehearsing by myself to kind of get reacquainted.
Were you going online to look at the tab, or did you remember?
I did.
You actually went online?
I didn't remember shit. And I had to download all the songs and buy software to slow them down and without changing the pitch. And I actually wrote tabs for everything.
Nice.
And then we published those tabs on our website. I did it as a Google Doc. I was like, well, I did it. I might as well share it with everyone.
This is a way to communicate your music.
Tab is like the notes, the written out.
I'm like Joe right now. I like don't understand what you're saying.
Tab is
short, really insecure.
Tab is short for tablature. Uh-huh. And tablature is a way to describe how to play
virtually, right?
Like no. Just guitar is very particular. Uh-huh. So sheet music for guitar doesn't make any sense.
Oh, it's where the fingers lie?
A critical part of guitar is where do the fingers go and on what fret are you in? Because if you say C, middle C on music, there's three different spots on the guitar where that middle C can exist. Yeah. So tablature says, no, you play it down here or up here, you bend this string or that string.
Got it.
So it's like a different kind of musical notation, and tab is for short. And so what I did was, and I didn't just do it just for me, but also for my bandmate who was maybe didn't have quite the work ethic I did, and I wanted to make it easier for him. But what I was going to say was, in the process of, you know, the first, I don't know, dozen times I rehearsed it was like impossible to not cry.
Oh.
I mean, it was just so overwhelming, sort of connecting to, you know, just, you know, most of the stuff I hadn't listened to, and, you know, I don't go around listening to my own music.
I listen to this podcast all the time.
I listen to our music.
Yeah, me too.
So, you know, to answer your question, I mean, there's, you know, if you're reporting on emotion and you're not feeling the emotion that you're reporting on, then you're doing a pretty bad job of reporting. You have to sort of convey that emotion. So if your music is all about anger, or your music is all about hate, or your music is all about depression, you might be, signing yourself up for stuff that, you might regret later. You know, it may have a negative impact on who you are as a person and
it's
where you go.
It's interesting because you want to be authentic. So if that's what you're feeling, you want to write it. But in 20 years later, you might not be able to feel it or perform it as well as you do you know, when you wrote it. So, now, which is fair. It's okay, right?
Some people, you know, seem to figure it out. I mean, all the guys in Metallica are still with us. And, you know, they seem to be doing okay. I mean, you know, from without revealing too much, I know... You know, there's some stuff going on there, but
yeah, I think when Lady Gaga performed with them, I think that was really probably a problem for them to really communicate the anger and the hate when she was just, you know, I watch the Grammys every year.
But it goes back to what you're saying. Like those guys are all really disciplined. They look great. I mean, at least physically to some degree, they stayed healthy.
Right.
Like, they may be doing drugs. I don't know. Or drinking heavily, but at least to some degree, they've been able to stay relatively healthy and fit.
If you can do this job, you know, for 20 years or however long, they clearly are probably not getting too far into any sort of substance. I mean, maybe that's a total farce. I have no idea, but I can't imagine you being, you know, a cocaine addict or a really bad alcoholic, you know, and do this physically demanding, mentally challenging job for 20 years, you know?
At some point, reality intrudes.
Yeah.
You can do it for a while,
right?
But sooner or later,
it's going to fall apart.
Gravity is gravity, and you're not going to escape it.
But if you had kept going, I mean, where do you think you guys would have ended up with your bandmate that was having problems? Do you think inevitably it would have caught up to him and been something serious?
Oh, we were on track to be dead within a year. Like, I somebody was going to die.
So it's sort of good you broke up for the health of everyone.
You know, at the time I was devastated. It was a multi-million-dollar recording deal and we were walking away from it.
Oh, wow.
All we had to do was stay together. Mm. And there was a massive advance coming to us on, you know, we just had to finish a cycle and everything was starting to open up. Like radio was playing, MTV was playing us. We were getting offered opening slots on arena tours. The thing is the, you know, the path that we were on, you know, particularly with my bandmate, I mean, it was heroin, it was crack, ecstasy, alcohol, often all of them all at once. Wow. And, you know, it was, you know, really just a matter of time before something really bad happened. And at his rate of progression, it was accelerating. It was picking up speed. It wasn't slow.
Yeah, you can't stop that trajectory once it goes, right?
You can't. And so, you know, I look back at it, and the funny thing is at the time I was devastated. Like I, you know, sort of woke up at 30 and the only thing I knew how to do was play guitar. And I, you know, I just lost my job.
Yeah.
And not only that, but like that particular kind of job, it's not like you just go apply for another one somewhere else. It's, that's it. You're over 30. So now you're also... It's like
old
for the scene.
Yeah,
like that's old for the scene.
Yeah, you're aged out. You know, you're like somebody shuts. You're a major league baseball player at like 37, and then they shut down your team.
Yeah.
You know, it's like
nowhere.
What
to
do
go.
I do?
Yeah. What do I do? And so at the time, it was you know, catastrophic, and I was terrifically depressed. Looking back on it, it was 100% the best thing that ever could have happened
to everyone.
To everyone. You know, perhaps particularly for my bandmate, but for me, you know, I just look at it as like, whew, we really dodged a bullet. Like that could have been bad.
Yeah.
And now it's just like, you know, this interesting memory.
Throwing more money and attention into the equation probably would have been catastrophic.
You go places, people are showering you with adoration and providing you guys with whatever drugs, alcohol you can handle or not handle. I mean, inevitably, it's almost impossible to not be sucked into that vortex.
Well, I mean, look, especially if you get any kind of notoriety for it.
Yeah.
I remember we played a show with Elliot Smith, and I was like, anything I can do to put myself between Elliot and my bandmate, I will do. I've got to keep these two guys apart.
Right.
And I was only semi-successful. I did some major cock blocking there,
but
strong.
They did eventually wind up hooking up at the end of the night and got up to, you know, no good. And 2 years later, Elliot was dead.
Thank you so much for coming. It was great to talk to you.
I sort of feel like I got to say you have a podcast that is about, medical stuff at times.
Sort of.
Yeah, at times. But I have one of the craziest medical stories I think you've ever heard in your life.
All right, everyone, that is the end of this episode, but it wasn't the end of our interview with Sharky. Before he left, he went on to tell us the most amazing medical story, and it was so good that we had to turn it into its own episode. So definitely stay tuned to the next release of the House of Pod, because I think you're really going to like that one. In the meantime, we want to thank Sharky for a great interview. If you haven't heard his band yet, check out Creeper Lagoon. Google them. Trust me, you won't regret it. They're a pretty important band to us. I think you're going to like them too. Also, check out bandigo.com. Don't forget to like us on Facebook. Review us on iTunes if you haven't. Tell your friends to listen. It really does help. We love your questions, so be sure to keep them coming at hopquestions@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail, anonymous or otherwise, at 408-444-6623. That's 408-444-6623. Mwah!
All anecdotes and patient-related details were changed with respect to date, sex, and certain details so that patient identification is not possible.